This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to the sixth edition of Word for Word. Thank you for tuning in today as I am Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where we're getting to know LGBTI influencers. Each week we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today our guest is an American screenwriter. He is a director, a television producer. He is the LGBTI activist from around the world. The most notably, he put together a film and not only put together this film and wrote it, but he won an Academy Award for his work based on the real-life person Harvey Milk. This man is a founding board member of the American Foundation for Equal Rights. He was the writer of 8, which was a staged reenactment of the federal trial that led to the court overturn of California's Proposition 8. He's married to the gorgeous diver Tom Daley, not to say that you're not gorgeous yourself, and together you guys are the ultimate power couple. Welcome to today's episode and welcome to Dustin Lance Black.
The Oscar goes to Dustin Lance Black. No.
I want to thank every single one of my LGBT brothers and sisters.
I was starting to see a much clearer path.
This wasn't the easiest subject matter to produce. It's pretty gay.
It gave me the hope to one day I could live my life openly as who I am and that maybe even I could fall in love and one day get married.
Wow. That was a lot. That was intimidating. I just try to take things one day at a time. That was the compression of a decade that, boy, I hope I can live up to in the next hour with you.
Yeah, well, for a lot of people, you know, when you're looking at, well, basically your Wikipedia, you look at all these listings of things that people have done, and you, my friend, have achieved a lot.
Thanks. there's a lot. There are many, many projects on my dry erase board here in London that feel like orphans. They're looking for homes, looking for production, you know, all of my babies who still need care. That's what I focus on. So I'm glad if we look back, it looks like things have happened. I have other children that I'd like to, you know, see brought into this world.
Yeah, I can only imagine the type of creativity which is bubbling away in the back of your mind. But let's go back to the origins of Dustin. You were born in America, in California, in Sacramento. Is that right?
Well, I was born there, but I was not raised there. So we moved when I was in a small child, really, to Texas. And so I grew up mostly in Texas, in San Antonio, right in the center of Texas. So I don't really have any memories beyond just the driveway and the sidewalk of our little home in Sacramento.
Well, I guess early memories can vary for most people, but thinking back, what were you like as a child?
Well, I was very, very shy. I was, you know, a mama's boy, as they say, and really by her side and modeled, you know, I think myself after her, really identified with her in many ways. And in some ways, I did so without understanding exactly why I was so similar. And it would only be later that I would put it together that, you know, here was my mom who had been paralyzed since she was 2 years old from polio and seen by the world as very, very different, treated very differently because of her difference. And I knew very early on that there was something different about me. I knew I saw the world differently. I had incredibly sensitive ears and hearing that had been diagnosed as such. And so I heard the world differently, which made me sensitive in some ways. And then, of course, by 6 years old, I had a crush on the boy down the block, not the girl. And so I hung close to my mom's hem.
Was there a link between, you know, your minorities, I guess, obviously your mother's polio and the way that she was treated could have been similar with the uncomfortability of your homosexuality?
Yeah, we both felt really different in the world. And certainly in Texas, once we landed in Texas, it wasn't always the most accepting that came to difference. We were very much encouraged to, you know, join the church that the rest of our friends went to. Well, that didn't work. My mom was Mormon, so we were different in that way as well. And most of my friends were, you know, Southern Baptist. And I remember the looks she would get because she was visibly very different. And I knew it wasn't, they weren't kind looks. They were fearful at best, judgmental on occasion, because here she was towing around three little boys with no father to be found. And I think some people questioned whether that was the best thing for us.
I guess some people fear the unfamiliar, and being that you weren't probably stereotypical, that was the judgment.
Yeah, that's an issue in our world, isn't it? And it's one we're seeing magnified globally right now, which is this tendency for people to draw closer to people who are similar, as opposed to being curious and looking out at the world and the variety and the infinite variety in the world with curiosity and saying, hey, who is that person who's very different? Who is this God they're praying to? Why are they dressed differently? Who do they love? Instead, we're in this time that feels to me regressive, which is about fear of difference, kind of like when a parent draws a child in for quote-unquote safety's sake, when they see someone very different walking along the street in downtown. I feel like, you know, I hope to never do that with my child. I hope, unless there is a real danger when we see someone different, I would encourage my child to ask questions, meet the person.
Mm.
Well, I don't think that's the tendency. I don't think that's where we're going in the world right now. We have people talking about walls to separate us from difference. And as you just said, a lot, confronting difference with fear, which, you know, I saw that happen with my mom. I've seen that happen with me. And, you know, and I think it's not only hurtful to individuals, I think it's hurtful to us as human beings on a planet.
Which begs the question on how we go about changing our behaviour towards the differences we have and the differences we have towards others. You know, growing up for you, what were the similarities that you had compared to your siblings?
Well, because there wasn't a father around for much of my childhood, I was in a way like a father figure to my little brother. And helped raise him, helped my mom raise him. So I've always just been incredibly proud of how well he's done. I'm looking forward to him, you know, being around throughout the holidays this year here in London. And, you know, and then I have my big brother who was always like a real tough guy. He was into heavy metal. He liked hunting. He liked watching NASCAR, which is, you know, just cars racing in circles for hours on end. You know, we just couldn't be more different.
You didn't look up to him in a father figure-y way?
No, I didn't. He was just my big brother, and he was a troublemaker. And yeah, I guess he checked more of the sort of stereotypical masculine quote-unquote boxes. But he also, you know, learned how to smoke first and probably messed around with drugs and alcohol first and lost interest in church. And, you know, but at the same time, listen, when I was making milk, I got a phone call from him. And he had been living at home again for some time. And he came out to me on the phone.
Really?
Yeah. So well, my big brother, who was the big tough guy, you know, defied all the stereotypes of what it meant to be gay. And, you know, it answered some questions why he hadn't had a girlfriend in a decade. And he was incredibly concerned with how he would exist as a gay man because he didn't want to move to one of the big cities on the more liberal coasts. He felt very at home in the South. He felt at home with people who like to, you know, go hunting and watch races. on television for hours drinking their Budweiser. And I remember he asked me, hey, are there any gay people like me out there?
That really puts heteronormativity, you know, underneath the microscope.
It's saying, hey, listen, we've come to see all these characteristics as masculine, feminine, gay or straight. And it's all kind of baloney, as we would say in Texas. It's not, you know, they're constructs. And he wasn't putting anything on to please or appease anyone. He was just being himself.
And I think that that's so important. I think that that's what you should be doing, is staying true to yourself. But I think for a lot of people, when they work out their sexuality, we go on a bit of a journey. And, you know, we do change a bit, because I think sometimes you can feel a bit insecure about your sexuality. And it can kind of throw you off course in a way. Are you still on that same path, or do you think when you came out, it changed who you were?
I mean, it changed the things that I was able to experience. So sure, it changed me, but anything would have. I'm not a static creature, a static person. I think I have my core values, but other than that, I do try to learn and change and not calcify. You know, I've seen so many of my friends start to go through this process of calcification where they wholeheartedly believe that what they've learned in life is true in every way. And I go, well, I think truth is changing in some ways. In some ways, there are absolutes. But in other ways, the world changes and we have to keep up and we learn more about who we are as people. And so certainly coming out exposed me to, you know, a much more fabulous scene. You know, I'm sure I started dressing a little differently. My vocabulary probably changed in some ways. And, you know, that has as much to do with coming out in Los Angeles as it would in any other city, because I would have been exposed to different things.
What did your family think of your sexuality when you came out? I mean, I don't know who you told first or whether you told them all together, but what did your immediate family think?
You know, my mom figured it out over one Christmas, and I wasn't really ready to tell anyone, particularly her. I didn't want to lose her. And I knew, you know, here's a conservative Mormon military mom, and we were at that point living in Virginia, but it was still a conservative area. It was well outside of D.C., and she didn't take it terrifically well. I mean, I think she was equal parts upset and concerned. I think she blamed herself in many ways. She thought she had done something wrong. And it's what I tell people when they ask me, how do you do it? When do you do it? And I say, well, try not to do it at Christmas. You know, there's already enough family pressures going on, and that will only make it more dramatic. But that's what happened with me. And I also say, keep the avenues of communication open. I mean, just because it doesn't go well at first, just because, you know, in a flash, your family doesn't completely understand it, doesn't mean that it won't get better. And it's hard work to keep those avenues of communication open, particularly when you're feeling judged for something you can't change.
Would you say that life is different now, or is life easier now that they're comfortable with your sexuality, and in a way you're comfortable with more comfortable with your sexuality?
You know, I mean, it became, certainly, life became easier once my mom figured out it was no one's fault, figured out I hadn't really changed. I had always been this person, and met my friends and heard their stories, which is really what helped. Really what helped was her meeting more and more and more LGBT people, and that dispelling things, the myths, the lies that she'd heard in church. Growing up, that she'd heard in the South. And really what it meant is I had my mom back, because in some ways I had lost her already by being closeted.
Do you think that maybe in some ways, because of the fact that you felt early on that you were letting your mom down, did that make you more like a people pleaser as you were getting older?
I don't know if I would ever... I was always, and I still am, a people pleaser.
Maybe you didn't know. Maybe you didn't know that that was the thing. You know, because a lot of the times when you talk to people, especially queer people, especially because they were concerned about their sexuality and they were concerned about what other people thought, they developed a knack of people pleasing, and then that continued on into their life.
Yeah, perhaps. I think I was also just a pretty sweet kid. if anything, I've gotten a little more strict in what it is I feel needs to happen and what deserves to happen and what kind of behavior needs to be corrected. So, but I, some of my, that balance for me has more to do with growing up with an incredibly kind, empathetic mother who taught me what it meant to, you know, be a good citizen and to, and to really, you know, what I always loved about my mom's Christian faith was that she believed before all else in the golden rule, which is to treat your neighbor how you'd like to be treated. And if you learn that, if that's what you take out of Christianity, well, boy, suddenly seems like a great religion. Makes the neighborhood better, makes families stronger. It's so many of the other rules that get us in trouble.
Well, I think that religion definitely serves a purpose. Like for me personally, I don't think all religions are bad. I mean, just because I'm not religious, but I certainly see that they play a part. And when you look at religion like the way you just explained that, there's certainly some tools that people learn from being religious that are helpful in today's society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't go to church anymore, certainly not weekly, certainly not to the Mormon church, but even in that church, which is so incredibly conservative, there is value there. And I have to acknowledge that for most of my family and many of my friends in the South, it's how they build community, not just family. It's how they survive in their world, in their city. It's where people get ahead in business and politics. It's where those conversations are happening. And I know in the Mormon church, when we hit really hard times financially as a family, they were there for us. I often say, like, it might be legal to keep LGBT people out of your church, and that's all right. You can make that law, but I think it's immoral. I think you're not just denying people faith, you're denying them community and family and support in many parts of the world.
When you look at it like that, I think it goes against the fundamentals of a large part of the church, you know, for some of their exclusions,
sure.
You know, which is not great. I think it's funny that you describe yourself as being shy when you were younger, and then you think of where you've been thrust into now, considering that you have a global profile and that you have such a strong following of people. Do you feel pressure by the fact that you have so many people, especially queer people around the world, who look up to you and follow you?
I mean, I feel more pressure from myself than from other people, if I'm being honest. I feel a pressure as a member of a community to do something to correct some of the ills that we see today, some of the erasure we have in the recording of our very diverse combined history. I feel like there's so much work to be done that I have a responsibility to help make things better for next generation. I mean, I think if there was ever a moment when I'm feeling unmotivated and coffee doesn't help, it only takes me thinking a bit about myself growing up in Texas and what that felt like, that isolation felt like, that lack of understanding that I had a history, that I had forefathers and foremothers, that feeling that I was very alone, that I might be the only person like me. And I think, okay, I have a responsibility to fix that. I'm in a position to help fix that. And that usually helps get me going. And digging deeper into our history to see what has been erased because of shame, because of the laws that made it illegal to record our history, and to start pulling up more stories and breathing life into them and hopefully sharing them with a new generation. So if anything, there's this, I feel pressure from my own childhood, which is really, let's be honest what that is. That's a pressure to make things better for a next generation, perhaps kids that aren't even born yet.
Mm-hmm. If you look back over time, I think that there's a real change in society globally when you wrote Harvey Milk. And then you think about you being that person growing up and all the thoughts and fears that you had, and now looking back on that and wanting to make an impact, did you ever think that you would be so successful that you would stand up in front of your peers, I guess, you know, and accepting like an Academy Award?
Never would have guessed it.
No.
And never would have guessed it the night before. those awards. I certainly was not something that we ever thought was possible when we were trying to make the film. And, you know, I mean, for the longest time, it was just me and a credit card. I mean, this was not a financed film. This was, you know, I'm known as the writer, but I was also the producer of the film. You know, and it was a struggle just to get it made. The idea that anyone would ever see it, holy moly, like, that was beyond amazing. So as we watched it, you know, fill up movie theaters in the United States and beyond, that was already incredibly impressive. And I went to, if I'm being honest, I went to a film school at UCLA, which kind of taught us not to focus on awards, not to focus on that sort of thing, that it's about the process. And that the awards are probably a distraction from doing your best work.
Absolutely. Well, I don't think anyone has ever been successful if they're just trying to look for fame, especially, certainly not in the film industry. So I guess the road to Oscars started somewhere with good intentions.
Well, you know, it happened slowly. I mean, over many, many years, I can keep stepping backward. I could step all the way back to when my mom remarried and my stepdad got orders to ship off to Central California. And all of a sudden, I'm in near San Francisco and Monterey and the theaters there. And I start working in them and I start learning about storytelling. You know, that was a big break. That was a turn of luck. If that hadn't happened, I'm not sure I would have found this great love I have of storytelling. You know, the next would be getting into UCLA's film school. That was an impossible mission. You know, everyone told me, boy, they only take, I don't remember what it was, 30 students a year, and they get thousands of applications. So that day I got that acceptance letter was a huge break. You know, and then they don't exactly start handing you feature films when you graduate, no matter how good your grades were. So there were many years of serving orange juice at a little breakfast cafe in Los Angeles. And the things you can do to make money, or the things you can do without a budget, without money, are documentaries and screenplays. And so that's what I started doing.
That's the question I was going to ask you. What was the gap between being a film student and coming across the desire to tell the story of Harvey Milk?
Well, that was there's a decade there. A decade before it came out. But, you know, my first jobs were in documentary, and it was because I'd made some on my own, put them into festivals. They'd gotten some attention from some people at the BBC, actually. And I got a job directing and producing Faking It. It was my first big break. I was probably 27 years old. So, probably, you know, 4 or 5 years had gone by since leaving college. And I'd served a lot of orange juice in that time. But, you know, all of a sudden, I had an agent, and that agent was getting a commission. And so that agent who was getting commission was beholden to read the scripts that I was writing. And so, and even though I don't know that he was a big fan of them.
Of your work. How many scripts did you write and send to him?
Dozens. And most of them are horrible, and I hope they're never discovered.
Have you still got them? Are they under your bed somewhere?
I hope not. I hope I've hit delete enough times that they're gone. But, you know, I with some success, I was doing these often LGBT-themed documentary projects that were getting some acclaim, and I had some screenplays that showed I had some amount of talent. And so putting that together, I was able to get my first TV movie, which was Pedro. To work with a man who was a hero of mine. He was the president of the Directors Guild until recently, and that's Paris Barclay.
Wow.
He's an openly gay, African-American, openly HIV-positive man with an amazing resume, and he had faith in me to hire me to write this script about his hero, Pedro Zamora, who, when reality TV was just beginning, he knew he was HIV-positive, he knew he was likely going to die of AIDS, and he did so in front of our nation in the United States. That broke me in. But my big break was getting the job writing the polygamous Mormon drama on HBO, Big Love. Oh. That was a huge break as a screenwriter.
Well, I can tell you that a friend of mine rang me one day and said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm at home and I'm sick." And he was like, "Come round and watch this TV series." And by that stage, Big Love, I think, was in series 2. But it was incredible writing, and I remember thinking it was provocative in a way to be talking about Mormon, but, you know, talking about their life. And I thought it was groundbreaking television that no one would be, like, I didn't think it was as universal as what it became. And then my mum, who's, you know, obviously a lot older than me, she rang me a few years later and discovered it as it was in its fourth season. And she was like, are you watching this show, Big Love? It's amazing. And you have to be good at what you do to connect with an audience globally.
There were a lot of us writing that show.
Yeah, I'm sure that they were. You can't take credit for it all.
I did a few of the episodes, you know, each season, and that's it. But I cut my teeth there. And the creators of that show, Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, were like parents to me and put a lot of faith in me. And, you know, and I learned a lot about what it meant to break a story and what's necessary and not necessary. And working with the executives at HBO at the time was such a golden era there. You know, Sopranos was still on, Six Feet Under was still on. And, you know, I took those lessons. And when there was a writer's strike and we had to stop working on Big Love, I decided to pick up my pen and do something I'd been dreaming of doing for, boy, a couple decades at that point, which was to bring Harvey's story to life. And it's partly thanks to that writer's strike that it became reality.
Well, things happen for a reason. Yeah. You know, I think sometimes the stars align and a bit of serendipity comes into it. But I think you were destined to write the story of Harvey Milk. I think you were destined to call it Milk. And I'm sure as all of the stars were aligning with getting the actors and the director, I think there's a process, but everything did come together because I felt it was the right time to tell that story.
Yeah, it was very interesting timing that we could not have seen coming, which was that in our country, in the month it was slated to come out, a proposition called Proposition 8, a statewide initiative in California, took away the right for us to marry. We had the right. It was taken away. And that parallel the story of Proposition 6 in Milk, it just seemed too eerily similar. The timing was in some ways heartbreaking because we had hoped maybe if it had come out sooner, it could have influenced things in a positive way in California. We could have won, you know, 2020 hindsight now. Listen, Proposition 8 might have been the best thing that ever happened to our community. You might understand that feeling in Australia right now. Which is having that very public fight, no matter how unfair. And it did feel unfair. And it probably felt unfair to you to have your lives put up to a public vote.
We were one of the last English-speaking countries in the world to change the laws on marriage and offer equality to all queer people. And it was a long road to be fought. But years before that fight, I remember sitting there watching. I love the Oscars, by the way, so I watch the Oscars every year with my best friend. And maybe it's because I'm gay. It is because I'm a gay man, but I remember thinking that that speech just resonated with me so much because it seemed so genuine. But what's interesting about being a writer is that you could easily be accused of being a good writer, and that's why the speech was so powerful. But to me, it felt like that speech came from the heart. For people who may not have heard the acceptance speech in 2007, I think it's appropriate for us to play it.
Oh, my God. This was not an easy film to make. And first off, I have to thank Cleve Jones and Ann Cronenberg and all the real-life people who shared their stories with me. And Gus Van Sant, Sean Penn, Emil Hirsch, Josh Brolin, James Franco, and our entire cast, my producers, Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen, everyone at Groundswell and Focus, for taking on the challenge of telling this life-saving story. When I was 13 years old, my beautiful mother and my father moved me from a conservative Mormon home in San Antonio, Texas, to California, and I heard the story of Harvey Milk. And it gave me hope. It gave me the hope to live my life. It gave me the hope to one day I could live my life openly as who I am, and that maybe even I could fall in love and one day get married. I want to thank my mom, who has always loved me for who I am, even when there was pressure not to. But most of all, If Harvey had not been taken from us 30 years ago, I think he'd want me to say to all of the gay and lesbian kids out there tonight who have been told that they are less than by their churches or by the government or by their families, that you are beautiful, wonderful creatures of value, and that no matter what anyone tells you, God does love you, and that very soon, I promise you, you will have equal rights federally across this great nation of ours. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, God, for giving us Harvey Milk.
Can you answer me this? Did you write that speech?
I didn't write it like you would write the dialogue for a screenplay where there's like a word for word thing. But in the morning of the show, I thought, okay, well, I need to put together what it is I would say if I did win. You know, and it was a competitive category. Wally was winning awards. I was winning awards. No one knew if it was going to be me or the cute little robot. And so I took a hike with a friend of mine, and I just started running through the ideas of, like, what would I have wanted to hear if I turned on the Oscars in San Antonio, Texas? And what would I have wanted to hear from that stage? And I just ran through some of those thoughts. And I was very savvy politically at that point about the marriage equality debate. We were already in the first throes of brainstorming around what kind of moves we would make to regain equality in California and beyond. And so I was well-versed in that. I was frustrated with the movement, the LGBT movement at the time. I felt it was making some of the same mistakes it was making before Milk and ignoring the lessons of Milk, which is, at a certain point, you have to enlist your allies, not just LGBT people. And because this is about coalition building. And secondly, we have to take the fight to the federal level. You have to make it nationwide for it to really matter. Any good civil rights fight understands that. And we weren't doing that. We had this sort of piecemeal, state by state, county by county, I think rather wimpy approach to our civil rights that I was sending a signal to the South saying, we don't think we're fully equal. We just think we're equal in this little area. And we only deserve this little piece of equality.
You thought you were fighting for a small piece and you felt like you should only fight for this small thing. But don't you think now you should be always fighting for equality?
No, I never thought we should fight for... I'm saying the opposite. I was frustrated with the movement at the time.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Really only doing statewide or only doing countywide initiatives.
Yeah, right.
And I thought it was time to follow in the footsteps, really, of the Black civil rights movement in America and take the fight to the federal level. And that's why when I got up on that stage, what I talked about was full federal equality and made a promise to young people that they'd have it. It was a huge promise. In the United States at that time, no leader in the movement thought that we were ready to take the fight to the federal government, that we were ready for a nationwide equality movement. They just didn't. They thought it was too soon. I got chewed out left and right by my own heroes in the movement when I got off that stage. It was not easy on the other side of that speech.
But, I mean, it's never been a really easy road, but I think it was still something that stands documented in time. I mean, you were the first out and first gay person recorded, really, to win an Academy Award. And not only that, but you really said something.
I don't know if that's true.
I read that as a stat at the time, and I just laughed at it, and I thought, well, I'm sure Dustin Lance Black doesn't believe that either. I'm sure because this community of people who work in this industry, surely there's been lots of people, LGBTI, along the way that have won Academy Awards that probably we haven't known that was their sexuality, you know. But for you in particular, it felt like you were the first person to make a speech that was about something that was important to queer people.
I have no idea.
You don't want to be able to say, yeah, you don't want to. And I understand that because I'm not even going to talk about this, but I know that there was a Twitter war with someone who I just was like, whatever. But, like, it's not necessarily about who was the first one or who wasn't. I think it's more about the fact that in my mind, and maybe it's just my life and the bubble that I live in, but I felt like that was the first time in the Academy Award winning history that I saw a person get up and speak from the heart, say something purposeful, and almost make themselves accountable for it. And that's kind of what you're saying about then being accountable and what that road was like afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I gave a really political gay speech because I was in a really political gay time. You know, but I'm pretty sure, and we could check the stats, but like, you know, I know I have some of my great heroes, like Bill Condon won an Oscar for Gods and Monsters, and he was definitely openly gay at the time. Elton John, yeah, and he was, I believe that was mid-90s, and he was certainly not closeted by then, I don't believe. It's not about, you know, and so I don't think you have to get up there and be political. You can just be yourself. You know, what I would... What I would ask people not to do is to make wild claims that they are the first without doing their research first. And, you know, and some of that is because it's like, I think it's important that we know we have a history. It's self-esteem building. It's strengthening to young people know they had forefathers and foremothers who came before them and did incredibly brave things. And those people who were openly gay and won before I did, were far braver to be open in their time than I was in my time. You know, in my time in California, I couldn't lose my job or be kicked out of my house for being gay. They could.
Mm.
For some of them, you know, it may still have been considered a crime where they lived when they won and were openly gay. I just happened to win I'm in a very political time and with a political gay movie and with really pressing issues in the United States that I felt needed to be addressed. And frankly, when I got up on that stage, I don't remember most of it. I just spoke from the heart.
Mm.
I felt, and my mom was there, and so I talked about her. I knew where we were politically, and so I talked about that. I knew what I would have wanted to hear as a kid, and so I voiced that. And I knew what we needed to do politically was to stop acting like we only deserved crumbs and to demand full federal equality in all matters governed by civil law in every state.
Absolutely.
And, you know, now I'm in a place where I believe we need to demand those same rights and protections globally. And until we tell the world that we know in our hearts, we know in our bones, we deserve full equality in all matters governed by law in the nation we live in, we will not be respected as full citizens because we haven't even asked to be treated as full citizens. We have to demand to be treated as full citizens no matter where we live if we ever expect our neighbors to respect us. We have to show self-respect enough to demand that. And it's going to take great courage for a lot of people in those other countries who are willing to stand up despite death penalties in some places and lead.
It's bit by bit, though, and it is about a generation that has come before us and who we are. Like, we are on a gradual process. It's generational, so I think it's going to breed out. You know, I think that there's going to be less and less people and more courageous people to even... more courageous people just believing in themselves and not even thinking that sexuality even means anything different, you know, and I think we will get
there. Well, you definitely won't get it sitting on our asses. In fact, we'll see rollback. We'll see the pendulum swing backward. We'll see our rights being taken away. We're seeing that in the United States right now, particularly with trans protections and inclusion. And that's an incredibly vulnerable, you know, part of our family. The trans part of our family is in danger in the United States right now. And if we become complacent in any way, if we look at the arc of history thus far and say, oh, it'll continue in this direction, we're kidding ourselves. Mm. That's not the nature of being a minority. I have people come up to me at my speeches in the United States in particular with tears in their eyes saying, well, when is it going to be done? When do we get to say, okay, we did it, and to get on with our lives? And I say, honey, you're a minority. It's never going to be done. The work will continue forever as long as we are minorities, and that's okay. It's noble work. It's strengthening work. It's work that feeds your soul. It's work that inspires others. It's worthy work. We can't get lazy. We can't get complacent because, as some people say, oh, this Trump thing, is just a blip in history. It's just the dying gasp of a dying breed. And I say, maybe if we don't push back, if we don't correct the record, if we don't help people see where the truth really lives, that can become the future. That can grow. It's our job to make sure it doesn't.
I think I want to get into that a little bit more, because I think what you're saying, and because you are an LGBTI activist, you know, who is so globally well known, and that you're not just fighting for your rights, you're fighting for everybody's rights. And there's more that I want to ask you about that coming up. But after you won for Harvey Milk, and you then got to walk into a different environment, I would say, you know, it's almost like having a blue tick on Twitter, you know, you're officiated and people know more about who you are. You then got to collaborate with different people, actors, directors, and other writers. What was the next big project for you?
Right away, we started making J. Edgar with Clint Eastwood and Leonardo DiCaprio. And, you know, it was a much more challenging story because it was not uplifting. It was the opposite of hope. It was the mirror of Milk. It was the cautionary tale of what can eat your soul away if you stay closeted. And so it wasn't as inspirational by design, and you know, and it was tough to make. I'm glad we made it to show what the converse of Milk is.
Yeah, with Edgar, I mean, that was an interesting film, I thought, for you to go and make, because Clint Eastwood is from a completely different generation, obviously someone who's worked in Hollywood his whole life, but has a different perspective on storytelling. Was it interesting to collaborate with Clint over this film?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it greatly. I mean, he has a very different way of working than what I was used to. I actually wanted changes made to the script, and he didn't, which is really interesting. It's usually the opposite. And, you know, he moves very, very fast. So, you know, it was a new place for me. It's also the only project I've ever done where I'm not a producer on it. So I did not have as much say.
It must be very difficult sometimes to write something and then watch other people produce your work, because it's, I guess, like giving away a baby in a way.
Yeah, no, it is. And it was hard, and probably not something I care to do again. I will not be writing anything
and giving it to a director, even if it is Clint Eastwood.
I just think, you know, I was raised in the theater. I was raised in television, where the writer is an integral part of the creative team all the way through to the end, whether that be casting or editing. And actually, Clint kept me very involved in all of that. It was very gracious of him. Very kind of him. But I come from that school of thought, and I'd like to stay, keep doing that. Well, I got derailed for a good half a decade after that. And, you know, I mean, the train ended up on a great track. I ended up helping found a foundation that sued for marriage equality at the federal level, took the case, the very first marriage case, to the Supreme Court in the United States. I mean, I basically, after J. Edgar, put filmmaking aside for 5 years.
But then look at that. Is there different levels of satisfaction that you get out of being a filmmaker over being a LGBTI activist?
It just felt like sometimes you find yourself in the position where you can help and you feel like you have a perspective that others don't, that could be helpful. And I have full faith that it was time to take the fight federal. I certainly didn't want to win equality for myself and leave my big brother out in Virginia. So there was something personal about it. And I was able to utilize the tools I had learned from filmmaking to support the case. I learned, hey, you're going to make more progress if you talk about the plaintiffs and their personal stories rather than the law and the science and the Constitution around it. That's not going to change a lot of minds. What will change minds are those personal stories. I knew that from filmmaking. And then when we needed to raise money, I wrote a play. And so I was able to put on a play called Eight in New York and then Los Angeles with these unbelievable casts, raised millions of dollars doing it. And to put that play on the road in the United States, it ended up playing in all 50 states I believe, 800 productions before our case got to the Supreme Court, acting as both a fundraising tool and an education tool, saying, hey, this is what this case is about. So I was able to use my tools still, but I wasn't making movies. There was nothing on the screen for years. My poor agents, bless them for their patience.
They wanted the money. They're like, any thoughts on working with Nicole Kidman? You know, like, any thoughts on putting pen to paper?
Well, that conversation did happen about Nicole Kidman, and I got to sit and have lunch with her about a project I really wanted to do. And unfortunately, neither she nor I got it.
What was she like to sit down and have lunch with?
I found her incredibly thoughtful, and it was an illuminating conversation. And she seemed very creative and open, and I have to say, a little magical.
There's
magic there.
You think about this, though. You've worked with some of the biggest names in show business. So I guess for you to say that Nicole Kidman has a bit of magic really means that there must be...
I will pat myself on the back and say I have a good magic meter. you can't always put a finger on what that is, and it's different from actor to actor. You know, Sean Penn has it. Leonardo DiCaprio has it. I've worked with some really wonderful people who have it. Jennifer Connelly has it. And then, of course, Nicole Kidman, she's absolutely stunning.
What was the project you were both working on?
I'm not going to tell you the title. It was a book.
Okay.
About a true story. We both loved. And in the end, the author of the book went with a different writer.
If I ever see your name with Nicole Kidman, I'll be like, well, he told me about a magical conversation. Anyway, look, we're going off on a tangent here, but getting back into some of these LGBTI themes, which obviously is such a huge part of your life, you know, I think we've been on a real journey with our sexuality, and it's been sort of a journey that has so many highs and so many lows. What do you think now will be our biggest struggle now that we're finding that marriage equality has been passed? You know, what do you think our next big struggles are?
Well, I think complacency, if I'm, you know, trying to tell your future, will be the biggest problem. After a big win like marriage equality, people can become complacent and say, okay, we've won this big thing and we've made it. But it's not true. There's more to do. And really, it's in terms of, I always say, it's about breaking down the myths, breaking down the lies, the distortions, and filling those in with personal stories that correct the record, that tell the truth. There's probably no place more critical that work happened than with our trans family members, and particularly trans family members of color, who their lives are literally at risk, certainly in the United States and beyond. And the way to strengthen it is to continue to tell your personal stories, to not become complacent. That's step one. Step two is LGBT people in your country got a lot of support from straight people and from other minorities. And if you now go and sit on your tail and congratulate yourself, and don't get up and go give back to those other communities of difference, not asking what they can continue to do for you, but what you can do for them. If you don't do that, the bridges will dissolve. You've got some strong bridges right now. Take care of them. Strengthen them. And you strengthen them by not becoming self-centered, not becoming myopic, but to reach out to other minorities in your country who are also in need and help them. Strengthen those bridges. You're going to need them to maintain the gains you've won.
Can I ask you, though, that's probably one of the things that interests me about you, is that, yes, you're a writer, an accomplished writer, you're an LGBT activist, but there's a lot of your personal life that you can access off social media. And the one thing I was going to say is that, is that your mantra, share your stories? Like, do you feel...
I think it's also who I married. I probably wouldn't be doing that if I hadn't married Tom. I mean... he's much more engaged in the social media world. He has a YouTube channel. He loves to document what he's doing, what he's cooking, his life, his workout routines. and sharing it with the world. He's very much an open book. He's been being filmed here in the UK since he was, what, 7, 8, 9 years old.
It's such an invasion of privacy. But I think, you know, for anyone that's listening to this right now, just to quickly let you know, I'm sure you know that Tom Daley, you know, is a diver. That's how he, a sports athlete from England. But also since then, you know, he's a media personality over there. And the two of you now have been married for...
We got married in June. I mean, we were together for a long time, I think. I mean, like half a decade. And we were engaged. We had a long engagement because we were waiting until after the Olympics to get married. Mm. And then in June, we got married, June 2019.
I want to touch on something just really delicately, and I want to touch on this, is that there was a lot of stuff in the media about your relationship. I mean, you did have some time apart and then you got back together. And the reason why I say that I touch on this delicately is that I think that there's a lot of respect that I have for your relationship, because at the end of the day, you're both real people.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty of which stories might have some truth and which were exaggerated, but you hit on one that was awfully exaggerated. That said, we also don't claim to be quote unquote perfect. And by the way, no one is. No relationship is perfect, whatever that means. I mean, I think we're perfectly imperfect. We have our little fights. They're usually awfully silly and about little things, and usually have more to do with our mood than any real problem. We don't claim to be perfect. Our relationship might look a little more, quote, heteronormative mm-hmm. than others. And that's just because that's who we are, I guess. You know, Tom was raised in a home and in a family that had a lot of happy marriages. No divorces I can think of. And I always dreamed of being in a relationship with someone and building a family and having another parent there to help raise the children, because I never had that. So ours might look a certain way because of who we are. There's no pressure for anyone in the world to follow along and do what it is we do. None. I don't think gay people need to get married. I don't think we need to pretend that we're the same as heterosexual people in any way. I don't encourage people to do that. I encourage my brothers and sisters and family members in the LGBTQIA movement to be as wild and wonderful and different and vibrant as they please. I want to fight for our right to be protected if we choose to have a family, but that's our choice. And you know what? And Tom and I, there'll be more messiness in the future, because welcome to being a human being.
I mean, seriously, we're allowed to spill, is what I say. You know, we're allowed to make mistakes, and, you know, we're allowed to be human. And there's sometimes things happen in our lives, but at the same time, it's so important to be true to yourself. Looking forward to the future, what do you think? Do you reckon that, do you looking forward to having children?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was raised Mormon, you know. You can take the kid out of the church, but you can't take that church out of the kid. I if I could have 12 of them right now.
You would do it.
I'd do it. Yeah. But it's more difficult for gay people than straight people. You can't just go pick up a bottle of wine and have a good night. So there's more to do and plan and costs and timing and questions to be answered. But it's certainly a priority for both of us. You know, Tom's been busy becoming world champion now, so he's had his hands full.
Well, he certainly has.
Finally beating the Chinese.
You know, I think it's important for you to champion your partner to be the best person or the best version of himself.
Yeah, I mean, welcome to some of the benefits of marriage.
People have been doing it for a long time, so, you know, it's not really that unusual, I guess.
Well, it's wonderful to have somebody who knows you very, very well, the good, the bad, the ugly, and knows how to support you. And Tom and I are both really driven, and we know what it takes to stay that way. And we also can both recognize in each other when we get into that sort of glum, not so motivated, maybe being a bit too hard on ourselves place, and to help each other out of it. That's been very, very helpful.
Well, I think that's a great place for us to leave this. I want to thank you so much for your time, but I also want to give you the opportunity. Do you have something you'd like to say to the queer community here in Australia?
Well, I would love to say thank you. Right now in the world, we're seeing people talk about the courage of building walls of passing laws that separate us. And what they're really talking about is fear. And I know for me, it was the middle of the night here when we got the results of the ballots in Australia, and it gave me hope. It lit me up inside. It told me that the arc of history might not be turning towards isolationism and fear, that there are some places where we're expanding our understanding still. And if Australia gave me hope, imagine what it did to young kids, LGBT kids, or any kid who's different in Iran or Uganda or Chechnya or Russia. It was likely life-saving what you accomplished in Australia. And all I'll say is, keep it up. Don't become complacent. Keep shining that bright light of hope. And now that you're in this rare and wonderful position, use that bright light of yours to shine and to shine that spotlight onto leaders in other nations who really need the attention to keep our people alive. Don't forget about our brothers and sisters abroad. Keep shining your light of hope for yourselves and for the world. And thank you for doing it. Thank you for the hard work it took.
Well, Dustin Lance Black, I want to thank you so much. Thank you so much for your inspirational words. Thank you for taking the time to chat to us out here in Australia.
No problem. Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.